Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
This week on Meetin' 3, we're exploring interactions from drug studies in a laboratory.
If this effect is as big as he's saying, somebody should have discovered this long before he did.
To global wisdom on avoiding hangovers.
Beber cerveza antes de tomar vino no previene los síntomas.
Bière sur vin et venant, vin sur bière et belle manière.
Beer before wine, you're going to be fine. Wine before beer, you're going to be queer.
To the novel recipes developed by an Indian-American family deep in the heart of Texas.
And then my mom's sort of coming to America and learning that white parents love to melt cheese on things to get their kids to eat it. She was like, this is genius.
Be sure to subscribe to Meet in Three. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Matt Crafton. We'll talk to Matt about Cabernet Sauvignon, Napa, and Chateau Montelena. We'll taste a Montelena cab for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Virginia-born, Matt Crafton received a degree in economics from the University of Virginia, then wine at UC Davis. He worked the vineyards of Virginia before moving west to continue his pursuit of wine. Ultimately, Matt landed at storied winery Chateau Montelena, where he has spent over a decade. In 2014, Bo Barrett appointed Matt to head winemaker. Is that all true, Matt?
So far. Thanks,
okay.
Sam.
Okay. All right. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Matt.
Thanks so much. My pleasure.
Let's give the listeners a little background context on who you are. So give me a little brief background on your journey in life and wine that got you currently to Montelena and you being the head winemaker.
That's a big question.
And remember what I told you earlier.
Yes. So, yes, I am from Virginia. I love Virginia. Shout out to everybody listening down there.
For lovers.
Yes. Aren't we all? And I think like most young people these days, went to college entirely too young at the University of Virginia, studied economics, and then kind of in my fourth year, I think I came to my right brain sensibilities and decided that it was time to start thinking about creating and making things better and making people happy. And that led me to, I don't know, take a sharp turn away from possibly New York or San Francisco finance or law and decided to take a $7 per hour cellar job in Virginia. My parents were very proud, as you can imagine.
I was just saying, a sharp turn from your parents loving you anymore.
They were paying the tuition. I'm sure they were thrilled. And so I ended up, actually, it's funny. I showed up for that job interview dressed for a finance job. So I was in like a suit and like nicely polished shoes and a briefcase, the whole shebang. And the winemaker I interviewed with was in, you know, a pair of jeans. He may have actually been in overalls. And it was like the most hilarious juxtaposition you could think of. But
that was the last time you dressed like that.
Yeah.
But tell me one thing. We get everything so far, but what's kind of burning inside that you want to do wine?
Sure.
Was there a family thing or an event or something that clarified all of that?
So I think it started off with just, you know, learning about wine to impress girls in college.
Okay.
Which I think is very legitimate. Okay. And kind of fell in love with the concept of this is something that's really beautiful and amazing and different and distinct, and there's so many layers just in terms of, you know, the art that goes into this, and then there's the purity of like creation, I think, is really what drove my dedication. And so I've always been one of those people who, when I learn something, I want to start at the very bottom. And so that's exactly what I did. I mean, I was dragging hoses and, you know, cleaning out tanks. And I stayed in Virginia for 3 years, working my way up before deciding it was time to move to California.
And ironically, Virginia has a fairly well-established, you know, winery and community.
It definitely does. When I was there, I think there were about 80 wineries, and now I think that number's doubled. And there's some people making some incredible wine.
Yeah. So you leave Virginia after 3 years to California. What's the plan?
The plan was just getting to California.
Okay.
And I knew I needed to go and further my education. I think I had enough, you know, brute force and ignorance to be able to figure things out as far as I could. So enrolled at UC Davis, and while I was in grad school, I worked for a bunch of really super smart winemakers, ended up working a lot in the vineyards, especially in Carneros and on the Sonoma side. And I think having that practical experience along with the education side was really, really valuable. And then after that, so Bo Barrett and Cam Perry hired me in 2008 on a one-year job, and I was really stoked.
What does that mean?
It was kind of like...
They had the out to throw you out of there?
Yeah,
stiff?
It was definitely like the Princess Bride kind of moment, like the Dread Pirate Roberts. It was like...
How did you come to Montalena and Barrett?
So it was really funny, actually. So I was looking for a job. I was getting ready to graduate, and I was really gung-ho about going to work for another winery, and I won't tell you who that was. They're still close friends. But it turned out the job just didn't shake out. And literally the day I found out that that other job wasn't going to work, I ended up getting an email from somebody saying, hey, are you still looking for a job? There's somebody in Calistoga that wants to hire. And I said, I'm looking like, holy cow, Calistoga is the furthest north end of Napa, furthest away from everything. And so I think my response was, I'd only be interested if it's Chateau Montalena. And the person was like, give me 5 minutes. And then I was on the phone with him. So
that's crazy.
Yeah, it was really cool. Super serendipitous.
So you go there 2008 at what role?
So I was an oenologist. And so I'd worked a lot in the vineyards. So my farming side, I think, was pretty strong. My cellar time from in Virginia and also working in Napa and Sonoma, I was really comfortable with all my cellar work. And the role of an oenologist is really, it's mostly lab work. And so you kind of have to understand those things, those three facets really well before you can, I think, start, you know, telling people what to do.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, with oenology, how does it break down as far as cellar and the grape and the finished product and field,
sure,
the growing grape?
Yeah, so they're all really related, as I think you know.
Right.
And that's sort of the best part of the job, is there aren't these silos or really specific delineations. So you get to see, as an oenologist, you get to do a lot of work on the chemistry side, on the biology side, and it kind of answers some of the questions about why we do certain things, right?
Right.
Because that's the big part of how you're successful, is answering that why question. And so I did that for 2 years.
But things have advanced so much, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, with data and analysis and what's
available.
I mean, do you use a lot of that stuff now?
So I think that's been the real change over the last 5 years, as I think this brand has continued to really grow and evolve. We're very forward-looking, and we're really excited about the future, and we like to use these very modern tools, but at the same time, keeping one foot in our heritage. I think that's really what sets us apart.
I think you're obliged to that than a lot of other wineries. And, you know, we'll talk about the winery and the legacy and all that. But no doubt, Cab is king in Napa.
No doubt.
And Cab is king at Montalena. Why is the grape so prominent in the region? Is it the climate? Is it the soil? Is it just good business? Because what you're paying for acreage? I mean... Well, what's your take on that?
So nowadays, I definitely think it's the latter. It's
okay.
it's good business. But I think originally, if you look back, you know, 30, 40 years ago, we were still figuring out the right grape in the right place is probably the best way of putting it. And I think that if you look at the successive major plantings in Napa, so you're talking about the first major prohibition, post-prohibition replanting in the 60s and 70s, right. People were still figuring that out. And then we had another replanting in the 80s and 90s after phylloxera came back.
Right.
And at least for us, we're now diving into our third replant on our estate. And that's, you know, 40 plus years with the same piece of ground, with all that insight, you start figuring out what really does well in certain places and why. And so I think the producers who, like us, who've been doing this long enough, understand that we put Cabernet where Cabernet is going to thrive.
Right.
We don't put Cabernet where it's not, but there are plenty of other wineries who are in a different position.
You're talking specifically about your properties.
Absolutely.
So you'll scope out the best opportunities.
Definitely.
Far as all of that. Bordeaux is also the other place where Cab is king, mm-hmm. among other varietals. I mean, can you draw any comparisons?
I don't think so. I think it's a different place.
Okay.
And I think that's kind of the magic of location, and that's the magic behind terroir, is even though we share the same variety, our expression is going to be totally different. You can't make Bordeaux in Napa Valley just like you can't make Napa Valley in Bordeaux.
So when you say expression, mm-hmm. can you describe a little, you know, a Napa Valley?
A little, yeah.
You know, and that expression as it's different to Bordeaux. I mean, just give me your take on this.
Sure. So, I mean, I can't speak for the Bordelais, and I'm not going to try to. But
what you perceive or what you think the Bordeaux is. But tell me Napa first.
Sure. So I think if you look at that concept of terroir, there is a component, obviously, of what's going on beneath the ground. And what makes Napa Valley so special are all the different soil orders and the topography, the geology. There's no place like Napa Valley. And then you layer that in, you know, the climate. And for those of you that have visited Napa, you know, it's a pretty small spot. If we're a quarter of the size of Bordeaux, I'd be shocked. But in that tiny 30-mile-long valley, the differences in just exposure, temperature, and we're talking, you know, hot, you know, the high temperature of the day and the low temperatures at night, the differences in the angles of the sun as you move your way up and how the rocks interface with things, that right there is so different.
So there's way more of those attributes than in Bordeaux.
Well, I think they're, you know, Bordeaux's figured out that there are, you know, there's a classification system, right? And,
right.
And they have so much, they have 150 plus years of going back and being able to look at, you know, how their soil interacts with and makes their wine. You have to remember that we lost like an entire generation of winemaking because of Prohibition. I mean,
right.
I'd say the American wine industry is probably at least a generation or two behind the French wine industry because of that.
Easily. You know, you talk about Bordeaux, goes back even further. I think one of the things that Napa gets, I don't know, knocked, but compared is ageability.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you like Napa wines better, good for you. You like Bordeaux better,
sure.
Good for you. You like both, great, drink them both. But I think one of the things people talk about is the potential for Napa wines to age as well as Bordeaux. How do you feel about that? I mean, you make wines that are built for the cellar. But let's talk about a bigger view.
The big picture? Yeah.
We want to
get really divisive here.
Is that a fair question? It's like, hey, don't schlep me a Napa wine guy in and ask me about ageability against Bordeaux. But it's definitely an issue.
That's definitely in our wheelhouse, though, I'd say. And I think that's the final piece of the last question you asked, which is the last element of terroir is definitely the hand of man, right?
Right.
I think that is on the farming side and the winemaking side. And at least with Montelena, we're really blessed with a site that lends itself towards making ageable wines. And
right.
I'd say that what we look for, we've never been one to follow trends. And I'd say that we're really, really proud of what we produce. And because of that, we try to make the wine that's really going to be the best representation of our site. I mean, think about how many site-driven wines there are in Napa Valley, maybe half a dozen or a dozen, and the rest are, as you said, they're made in a very, very different way. But
right. So, like I said, I mean, you're with all the tools you have, you're building a wine to drink and to age. And
yes.
I guess the answer is that's not necessarily what everyone's doing because they don't want or they can't.
Right.
You know, they don't have the property and all of that. But you would compare ageability with the good stuff.
Absolutely.
Anything. Yeah.
We've said from the beginning, we're always willing to, you know, put our wines up against, you know, the best of Bordeaux. If we could do a 20-year vertical without skipping any vintage, we'd be more than happy to do that.
Well, when we talk about Montalena, you'll give everybody a little brief history of the Paris tasting, which ties all that in.
Sure.
But before we leave talking about Napa and Cab and all of that, there's definitely been a movement towards restraint mm-hmm. in Cab, towards restraint with wines, I think. You know, this whole natural wine movement and all that. People are dialing things back. Ironically, that's not you. That's not, you know, Montalena. Do you see that restraint going on and you continue to build a wine, a bigger wine? Is that history? Stay with the history of the winery legacy?
I think it's a good question. Restraint is definitely a buzzword now that people like to throw around. There are a few of those. It's tough to define, right?
Right.
And I think for us, we definitely don't make what I would consider to be uber modern wines. I think our wines have always had. I mean,
what would you define as a modern wine?
Like, as in who? Or
well, if after the show, if somebody tastes a Montalena sure. and they realize you're saying, you know, here's the way we build it, and it's not necessarily modern. How do you define modern?
So, maybe I should define us first.
Go ahead.
So, I'd say we're almost something I would call it almost neoclassical in that it's a very, for those people who do drink Bordeaux, you'll recognize the structure and stature of our wines.
Right.
But there is something very unique about Napa Valley, Calistoga, our property. There's a flavor profile and texture you can't find anywhere else in the world. And that, to your point, lends right. itself to aging. And I think other people are, for whatever reason, have decided that the best expression of what they're making may have, I don't know, how we want to define it, but it's going to be different from that, right?
Right.
It's more about, maybe it's more about the hand of man in the process. Maybe it's about, you know, in America, we like everything bigger and better. Maybe it's bigger, bolder. Maybe it's more ripe. Maybe it's more alcoholic.
More oak.
Yeah, exactly. So it's something I think it's tough to put your finger on it, but it's not something that we really follow. We just kind of, we stick to our guns and we make what okay. we think is the best expression for us.
Okay. After Cab, and I would say Chard's pretty well planted mm-hmm. in Napa. I mean, do you see another grape emerging? I mean, you could start with your properties, and then as you look out to Napa, is it basically going to stay that course, or do you see, you know, others? I know Merlot is pretty mm-hmm. big, but is anything coming down the pike?
That's a good question. Well, for us, we have one leg in Bordeaux, so to speak, with the Cabernet.
Right.
And then as you alluded to, we have a legacy in Chardonnay, which is really fun, and that's a completely different, you know, hat to wear, so to speak. And then we make Zinfandel. We grow it on our property. And there's a Primitivo is a component of that. As you know, they're the same variety.
Same, right?
And so we make that because we like to drink it. And we also make some Riesling. That comes from up in Potter Valley. So I like to say there are these.
Where's Potter? Mendocino?
It is. Mendocino. It's inland.
It's funny how this big legacy cab maker is making a Riesling. Who pushed for that?
It's old school, right?
Is it?
So the Riesling was the first wine we released in 1972.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So it's really old school.
Yeah. I mean, and that's
before it was cool and sommeliers
right.
fell in love
really
with
cool.
it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And before it was hip and trendy. So I mean, that's one of the benefits about being a small family brand is it's not all about the bean counters and it's not all about the profit. We make what we like to drink and we make it in a way that we think is really delicious. That's really what it comes down to.
I think the answer sort of projects that what you do is what the Valley does. You kind of stick to, you know, what's important. what grows well, what's good for that, you know, winery, and then maybe go out to a few things. I mean, if you go to like the Loire, you know, there's or Alsace, a zillion different grapes.
Right.
That's not going to happen so much in Napa, I guess.
I think that you asked about like the finance side at the beginning. I think the economics are going to drive of that. Exactly.
Yeah.
But I mean, that being said, we have Petit Verdot on our property. We have Cabernet Franc. We have some Petit Syrah that we like. I mean, all these are, you know, colors in the palette, so to speak.
Right.
And they're all really fun to work with.
And
in
I think
own way.
A bunch of other people are doing that, which is nice. And then some people have projects with some interesting grapes. But I think you're right, the location and the economics.
Yeah, I mean, if you're in a great, if you have a great piece of ground for Bordeaux varieties, why are you going to mess around with something else?
I agree. All right, let's talk about Chateau Montelena.
Sure.
Do two things for me. Give me a brief history of the winery, because it warrants a few minutes of that.
That's
you know, not everybody has a winery, you know, that has a legacy. And then talk about the Paris 76 tasting, you know, what it meant to wine and how Montelena was involved. And you did a good job with your bio.
Did you like that?
Don't go too crazy on it, because I want to talk about the winery and the wine.
For sure. So Chateau Montelena was founded in 1882 by a gentleman named Alfred Tubbs. And the Tubbs family owned it and, I guess, built it into a thriving business, essentially up until Prohibition. Prohibition shuts down essentially all winemaking with a few exceptions. And at that point, we basically turned into one of the many ghost wineries. Their winery was privately owned. We had an owner who, Yort and Jeannie Frank, they used the castle as their house. Not a bad deal. And but it was Jim Barrett and in the early 1970s who put the castle, the name, and the vineyards back together. And at the time, you know, there were a few, you know, Robert Mondavi was around, Charles Krug, that winery was around, but there weren't a whole lot of other wineries really thriving in the valley in the early 70s.
And when you say castle, I mean, you're alluding to the fact that the physical property was different than anything else.
That's right. So I probably should have mentioned that. So Alfred Tubbs brought an architect in from France and built an absolutely beautiful castle that's now on the National Historic Register. So that's literally where we still make our wine today.
Right.
And people are
retooled it a little.
A little bit, yeah. It's not quite the same inside, at least. But it's really special. And I think if you drive up to the top of the valley where we are, people are shocked to see this castle sitting right there.
And talk about the rest of the property.
That's
for
right.
a second.
So Yort and Jeannie Frank, when they owned the wine or the castle at the time as their house, Yort figured he had to have a moat around his castle. And so he dug what is now Jade Lake. Jade was his wife's nickname. And so we have this really amazing, like, Chinese inspired lake. So it's, you know, French castle, Chinese lake, Irish ownership. Everybody's welcome. So
it's totally unique. I mean, it's a great place to sit down, drink a glass of wine,
it
have
is.
A little picnic or whatever. So that's the property. We'll talk a little about the wine and all that. But talk about the Paris 76 tasting and how it involved Montelena.
Sure.
It's hard not to feel proud about that and be part of that history.
Definitely. And that's an important part of our history. So when Jim Barrett purchased the property, it needed to be completely replanted, as you can imagine, just years and years of neglect. And it's one of the most unique sites, I'd say, in Napa Valley. And I've worked on a lot of different vineyards. It sits at the base of this beautiful alluvial fan, and there's this volcanic ash, you know, washing down. It's an amazing site. So Jim needed to replant. He hires Mike Gergich as his winemaker. And what do you need to replant? You need money. And so they decided to start making Riesling and Chardonnay essentially as cash flow. And I wish there was a more romantic reason for it, but that's where the rubber meets the road.
The reason's the reason.
And so the second vintage of the Chardonnay, the 1973, was included in a tasting by Steven Spurrier. That pitted some of these upstarts from California on both the Chardonnay side and the Cabernet side with some of the best wineries in Bordeaux and in Burgundy.
So Stephen was an Englishman?
He was an Englishman.
And what was he, a journalist or a winery owner, a wine shop owner?
He owned a wine shop in Paris, and this was, I don't know if this was a PR stunt or what, but I don't think anyone gave us a chance of winning. And all the judges were all French and were the prominent enologists and winery owners of the day. And I think now it's turned into this super celebrated event, but at the time, I think it was just George Tabor with Time Magazine was the only journalist who was there.
Okay.
So, but I think, you know, our victory on the Chardonnay.
So Gergich makes the Chard.
He does.
Among the wines included from the States is the Chard. I think there was a Chalon or something.
Yep, and Freemark Abbey was in there. There were a few in there.
And a bunch of French guys are tasting it, and what happened?
So I think they tasted through. Obviously, I wasn't there.
You're talking white Burgundy.
Exactly,
there, right?
And they're thinking, oh my gosh, this wine's terrible. It must be from California. And back to France, and then all of a sudden things, you know, the scores are revealed and there's this shock. And it was, it really, I think, set off a fire in the world that, hey, we can find great wines outside of France. And I think it inspired a whole generation of winery owners and winemakers to seek out new places and to, I don't know.
That was sort of the beginning of credibility.
It was. That's exactly what it was.
And attention and all of that. Are there still any of those wines hidden in the
There are.
Is it, the 73?
There are a few, the 73.
That's pretty special.
You bring your checkbook next time. We'll make that work.
So that story is unique to Montalena and a couple other wineries, and it was a big deal. Let's talk about the winery a little. Let's talk about a broader subject, sustainability, which I know is a charge of yours. What does that mean? Sustainability for a winery, for what you want to do, and for Chateau Montalena.
It's a big question.
Yeah, it's like this is a natural potato chip.
Exactly.
This is a sustainable wine.
Right. What is it, right? So when I started at Montalena in 2008, I noticed that we were doing all of these amazing things in the vineyard and the winery, but we weren't really talking about them because it was just part of good farming. It was a part of being good stewards of the land.
You did it because it's best and right.
That's exactly right. And, you know, Bo will tell you, just like my little kids run around in the vineyards now, so did his. And you wouldn't do anything to your farm that could possibly be harmful or hurtful. And so we wanted to make the best wine we could. And so we put forth those practices that we knew would take care of, you know, our two greatest assets, our people and our land. And so, yeah, at the time, it was just part of who we were. And I said, well, wait a minute. We should get some credit for what we're doing here because it's not necessarily the easy way of doing things, but it's the right way. And so all I did was I started just listening to people and talking to some of the old timers who'd been around since the beginning and started writing things down. And then I just said, this is an important story we have to tell. And it's also, I'd say, it's a big part of who we are as leaders. And I somehow became the champion of this in getting our Napa Green certification, fish-friendly farming certification.
So what are the things you have to do to get those certifications? I mean, what are some of the specific things you practice now?
Absolutely. So I think a lot of it has to do with just being a smart farmer, right? So It starts in the field. And I think, and we talked about this a little bit before, which was starting to incorporate some technology, but also, so it looks at you know, conserving our natural resources. It looks at, well, what's going to give the vineyard its greatest longevity? There's an eye towards quality, of course. And I mean, and that's really what it's all about. We don't think those are two different targets. We think you can grow the best possible fruit in a fashion that's also very environmentally sound and friendly, that also allows our partners to make money so that their family farms can continue. And we also have to have this a great standard of living for the 70 families that depend on Chateau Montalena. Right. So it's those facets kind of weave together, I guess.
So specifically, I mean, are you practicing organics?
Sure.
Organic style, biodynamics? I mean, what are you doing out there?
So biodynamics is a whole different story. Right. We can do a different show on that. yes, we do. We do farm organically.
Bury that horn.
we do farm organically. No, we don't have a certification. I think that has to do with, remember, organics kind of tells you what not to do. That's really how organics works. Thou shalt not use X.
Right.
And so, whereas I think sustainable farming is all very proactive, and it encourages us to, if you look at your soil as a bank, that's what our vineyard manager calls it. If you're going to make withdrawals and taking fruit out of the field, you have to make deposits also. So that's, you know, building up the soil, microbiology, that's with compost, no synthetic fertilizers. We really don't use any pesticides. It's being conscious of that and looking not towards next year, but to the next generation of folks who are going to be farming here.
Is it harder, more expensive? Do you net the same results?
Right. It's a great question.
Are you feeling good about it? But, you know, in the end, you're making wine. It's working that way for you, too.
So I think that we feel great about it. I'm not much of a feeler, I'd say, in general, but okay. I do feel good about it. I think that in a lot of ways, it is about doing something the right way. And sometimes that is the hard way. So, and we have to balance that. We have to balance the, okay, well, we're going to be, instead of spraying a pesticide or spraying an herbicide, we're going to be pulling a hoe plow. Well, there's diesel for the tractors. Like, you have to think about that and the carbon side of things. So it's a balance, and you have to look at the net result. But I think rarely do we see a conflict where it's like, well, we really should farm this way, but this is going to be detrimental to the fruit. You know, 45 years of farming the site has really shown us that we can do both things. We can accomplish both goods. And I'd say more than any other place I've ever been, we have an ownership group and we have employees who really believe in it. And I think the results really speak for themselves.
Do you feel the rest of the valley is because we're talking about soil mm-hmm. for generations. Mm-hmm. If the valley's about making wine, it's about healthy soil. Mm-hmm. Do you feel the rest of the valley is understanding and partaking in that?
I think that if they want to be around for the next 10, 20, 50 years, whatever it is, they're going.
So what is that, a no?
No, I think that you know, there are 400 wineries in the valley, right? And I think there's some wineries like ours who recognize the big picture. And we see new wineries popping up every day, and they think, I'm here to make a quick buck, or I want some prestige, you know, project to feed my ego. But eventually they have to get in line and say that, wow, if I'm going to do this the right way, I need to start taking care of the piece of ground that I have.
Right.
And I'd say that the vast majority of people do recognize that. And
so the shift is going in the right direction.
Absolutely. And I think it's really market driven. I mean, when people ask us about this, and when customers say that this is important, well, great, we can talk about it.
Right.
And it's something we've always been proud of. And now people are just starting to take note of it.
Right. Let's hope, you know, that's the case times 10.
Yes.
That at some point, you know, you answer the question emphatically.
Yes.
You know, and that the valley is protecting soils and, you know, thinking about sustainability. I know we talked about this briefly, but get into it a little more. When we talk about Montalena specifically, you talked about having this very kind of big, cool palette.
Yes.
So soil, terrain, climate, I mean, you've been dealt a good deal on this.
Yeah, I have a lot to live up to.
Well, yeah, or, you know, if you screw it up, you look like a dummy or whatever. But, you know, talk about, you know, the diversity of soils, you know, the climates, everything that you have to deal with to make the wines.
So,
Talk about, you know, you're a big winery now, so you grow estate-grown wines, which are on your own.
We're not that big, Sam.
Okay. But you contract some wine. So just talk about that big picture.
Sure. So maybe I'll answer your last question first.
Okay.
So with the Chardonnay we make, we do have a couple partners in that. And it's more about finding that right place. And if we could, we don't make that much Chardonnay. You know, we make 10,000 cases of it.
And you're right. You're not a big winery. I think that the legend, the name is bigger than the
people
output.
Think
but
we're
both
massive.
Are good.
They are.
Yeah. And so it's not this mass-producing wine.
No, let's
take that off the table.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's once we get to the point where we can't taste through everything, we know we're too big. And so, and there are really no plans for volume growth. Again, that's a really wonderful part of our ownership. But we do. We have one very specific place we think our Chardonnay can be grown to make the style that we like. And we can't obviously buy every vineyard in that tiny little location. Incidentally, that's on the west side of the Oak Knoll District.
Okay.
It's at that sweet spot where we get enough fog in the morning, but also the afternoon heat to make a non-Malo Chardonnay. And so we work with, we have our own vineyard there, and then a couple of the other, you know, family farmers in the area do grow some grapes for us. And then we do have one partner in our Napa Cabernet. We have one family there, and they're the only partner we have in that. And everything else we grow ourselves.
So your grapes and their grapes are the only grapes.
That's right. And so
Has that been a long-term relationship?
It is, 25 plus years, which is great. And so we're very, very careful about our relationships. We don't need to, you know, crank out a certain volume every year. It's about the right relationship with the right site that makes the wine better.
That's what matters.
And that ties back to your first question about what makes, you know, the Montalena estate unique. And I think it's, you know, Bo started talking about this in the 80s before anyone was really even thinking about it, was, is it above the ground? Is it the beautiful sunshine and flowers? Or is it what's going on beneath? And it's really both. And so for our small little, you know, 120-acre piece of ground, we've about 100 acres planted, you see more soil diversity on that small plot than you do in almost any other vineyard in the valley of that size. So you alluded to talking about colors of the palette, and that's what I say. And it gives you all these amazing tools to, if farmed properly, to make something that's really unique and really special.
So literally, lots vary because of soil, and when you blend, the characteristic of that lot gives you the opportunity, you know, for that diversity.
I mean, and like, to give you a specific example, there are Cabernet vines that are literally 25 meters away from each other. One vine is in straight volcanic ash. It's this like orange solid rock called rhyolite, and then you literally go 25 meters away and you're in this cobbly alluvium.
And you pick the grapes, you taste them, and you could tell.
Yeah, we were doing the math last night on how many grapes we eat during harvest. It's something like 10,000.
You better like
grapes, frightening,
man.
Right.
You know? Talk to me about vintages. I think Napa's been blessed with some decent vintages. So we'll talk about the wine in a minute, but what current vintage is on the market?
Sure. So with Chardonnay, that's going to be our 2016.
Okay.
And with the Estate Cabernet, that's going to be 15. But as I think you probably know, one of the amazing things about Montalena is that we hold back anywhere from 5 to 10% of our production every year for those two wines for re-release.
Right.
And typically, when we release a Chardonnay, we also release the vintage 5 years before as well. So the 16 and 11 are together in the market. And then with the Estate Cabernet, it's usually the current release and the vintage 10 years previous. So the 5 and the 15 are together.
And I think people are going to have to play that back.
but talk, too much math.
Talk to me about vintages, not necessarily the wine. 18 recently ended. Was that a good vintage?
Right. So
for Montalena?
So I think yes. So the short answer is yes. For us, we don't look at vintages as good and bad. It's really about how we express the wines. And maybe this ties into your modern question, maybe.
Yeah.
It's that we're not looking to make some wine that fits into a certain box. We know we've been successful if we've been able to take the best parts of every vintage we're given and changing our winemaking to be able to express that in the wine. It's a really fun challenge to have. But if you're really into
it. So the vintage is the vintage. The question I had, you know, which was going to follow, which kind of falls into what you're saying, is do you follow a style, a formula? Is it about nature? Is it about the vintage? And you started answering that. The first part is there a Montalena style or formula that, regardless of what you want to do, this is who we are, you got to follow? So how does that work, you know, vintage by vintage? And is there a style? I mean, explain that long question as best as you can.
Yeah, there's no safe that we open up and take out, like, the recipe for Coca-Cola. There's none of that. It's, if there's any style,
because of what's dealt to you.
That's
like
right.
Like you were talking
exactly
about.
And I'd say it's much more challenging to do it the way we do it, but you have to have that that little bit of right brain craziness to love this, because you are really starting from scratch every year in terms of how we're going to make the wine, and we really let the common thread be the site. And but you need a unique site to be able to do that. And I think a lot of people have that. We definitely do.
So the wines are known for being rich, integrated oak. There's a purity of fruit, texture, structure. Would you say that all comes out every vintage?
Yes, and it's in its own way.
Some of those things, more tannic, less tannic wine.
Well, we're talking about restraint, right? And sometimes the smart thing to do is to not go full throttle on something. We want all of those nuances to come out every year. I want you to be able to taste the 2018 in the glass when it's eventually released. And that's going to be different from the 15 because it was a completely different vintage.
Right. That's fair. We're talking to Matt Crafton. Matt is the winemaker, Chateau Montalena. We're going to take a quick break. But before we take the break, I just wanted to ask you one last thing. Any wines, varietals, regions that are exciting you now? Outside of obviously the confines of Chateau Montalena and the insulated world of Napa Valley.
Absolutely.
Well, so, what's turning you on?
So my family, we typically take a trip up to the Willamette, usually every year. And so I have a lot of friends from my Pinot Noir days who've migrated up that way.
You like what's going on there?
I think it's really cool. I think it's a huge valley, as you know, and they're just still starting to work on the valley floor. Very few people are working the hillsides yet,
right.
Which is, I think, where the magic's going to come from, right?
Yeah.
And so seeing that industry develop and what people are doing creatively, I think, is really super cool.
Anywhere else? Out of the country?
Out of the country right now, probably Spain. I've always been a big fan of wines from Priorat. They're tough to find in California,
so
unfortunately.
So in Spain, Priorat's the region that you favor the most.
Yeah, I love the slate there. I think that's something we don't typically have get to play with.
We'll get more out of you when I subject you to our wine list.
Okay.
Matt, we're going to take a quick break. We're talking to Matt Crafton, the head winemaker at Chateau Montalena. You're listening to The Grape Nation. We'll be right back.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com. Just live the way you wish.
Did you fight for you? All right, we're back. We're back with our guest, Matt Crafton. Matt is the winemaker, Chateau Montalena. Matt, we don't let anybody leave the show without answering our wine list. Five questions. We didn't brief you on any of these. Don't excel or obsess. They're very base. First question is, what are you drinking now? And you may have answered it with Oregon, but think beyond. What's in the fridge? What's on the table? What's tickling your... And this is not just tasting Montalena wine.
Sure. So I'd say that is definitely probably... the number one region that is tickling my fancy right now.
Is Oregon?
Definitely.
Would you be so kind as to direct us to an interesting wine or two specifically?
Sure. Some of my favorite producers would have to be, I think, what Domaine Drun is doing there. There's a really wonderful small project with a former Montalena colleague named Greg Ralston. His label's Lavinia, and those wines are...
Spell.
Lavinia.
Okay.
And that's a really small production wine. Isabelle Meunier is the winemaker there. And I'd say our friends up at Ponzi. I think one of the things, you know, Oregon does that I think is very different from Napa Valley is they'll look for diversity in their wines by planting different clones on the same piece of ground.
Right.
Whereas we will, you know, maybe farm based on soil type, and then we'll change our clones based on that. They'll put like 20 different clones on one piece and let that build the diversity in their wines.
That's crazy.
So it's a really different focus. Let's think who else. Bethel Heights is a favorite.
Give me one more.
Bergstrom.
Okay, those are all, you know, some of those are very well known.
Yes.
Lavinia is probably new to some people. I'm the one dwelling on the question now. And do you draw any comparisons to Oregon, Pinot, and Burgundy?
It's a different place. I think
the wine itself,
the
place produces a different...
Well, you can see that so many Burgundians have moved into Oregon, so that says something, right?
Yeah.
And yes, there's the, you know, the...
So the aspirations seem to be going east to west.
Yes.
You know, the Europeans are coming in, which is cool. All right, we're done with that question.
Okay.
Tell me your favorite wine and food pairing. Do you have one? Not something you eat every night, even every month,
sure.
But what? And we have a rule on the Grape Nation.
Okay, what's
the rule? Can't say champagne and oysters.
Okay, well, that's...
All right?
I don't think I do that anyway.
So you got to give me something else.
So
you like champagne, right?
Of course, who doesn't? I'd say, let's do a Montalena one first. I'd say Montalena Chardonnay and smoked salmon with creme fraiche.
Okay.
That's, I think, the acid in our wine and the smokiness in the salmon are a really nice component. And then I'll give you a good one, a crazy one. So
this is your favorite, not picking a pairing.
Totally.
Go ahead.
I'd say older Petite Syrah and Lamb.
Now, how old? Early 2000s?
Yes,
90s.
Exactly. Yeah, okay. I'd say early 2000s okay. If you find a good
producer. Why does... Lamb is gamey, a little oily. Why does Petite Syrah work so well with
that? I think it has to be older Petite Syrah. You have to get past that massive tannin structure and get down to some of the basics. That variety has just incredibly beautiful earth tones that seem to just pair really well with lamb. So
that could be a first on the Grape Nation, Petite Syrah and lamb. Well, we'll have to check it. Do you have a favorite wine restaurant and or bar, a place that does it well, you feel comfortable, the selection's great, the knowledge, and probably for you, you know, in your area, unless you have such a favorite place in New York or Paris? Just give me a few places.
I wish I had a favorite in New York or Paris.
Okay. You don't get out of the cellar much.
No, they don't let me out much. So, and in general, I'd say I don't really hit wine bars very often, believe it or not. Usually at the end of a day or whatever, I'm looking for a cocktail or something like that. But I'd say in Napa, the first one would be Cadet Wine Bar.
Down in Napa.
Yep, that's a fun one.
They've been around a while.
Yeah, and they have a great wine list, and usually you run into a lot of industry people there.
That's a good one.
I think the other one, just because of the depth of the list, would be Press in St. Helena.
Right.
Amanda has just an absolutely fantastic selection, including some old
wine. And a good restaurant, too.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, so that's a good answer. How about Matt Crafton's favorite all-time wine? One, it could be two.
Okay.
When I started asking that question, it boiled down to the person's experience with the rarest or most expensive wine.
Okay.
It morphed into the experience.
Okay.
Here's the champagne I drank when I got engaged and all that. What wine still sort of resonates?
So I'd say two come to mind. The first one would be when I was working in the cellar in Virginia. Again, didn't really know what I was into, didn't know what I was in for. And the winemaker I was working for brought out a 1974 Heights Martha's Vineyard, and I got it.
That's the gold standard,
right?
That
was it. And at that point, I said, holy cow, look at how old this wine is. Look how amazing it is. This is what I'm going to do for
when
the rest
was
of my
that?
Life. It must have been 2003, 2004.
I had it probably 2008 and 9, and it was still...
rocking, I'm sure.
Yeah, it was like...
beautiful wine.
You know, and I'm with a bunch of Bordeaux and Burgundy guys, and they were like, oh, wow. Is there a 74 Montalena?
There is. So remember
anybody ever crack into that?
Whenever we can.
Okay.
So you have to remember we were replanting back then. So the Montalena Cabernets we made in the 70s up until about the 78 vintage were typically sourced.
Right.
So North Coast, Sonoma,
not
Napa,
a real representation.
Right. Not necessarily of the site, but they're really fun little curios. If you can find one, it's absolutely worth picking up.
Yeah. The Heights is a terrific choice. All right, last question. Answer this to the best of your ability, because you're a winemaker. You're this cloistered guy who never sees the sun that much and gets out and doesn't go to wine bars. And I feel for you, but that's okay. Tell me, in your mind, retail, best wine around $15-$20. I need a red. I need a white.
Can they be from the same producer?
Yeah, but that's boring. But it's okay. I don't want to call you boring before you answer the question. You can give me a grape, like Muscadet is a great value. You can give me a region, the Loire. You can give me the maker. You can give me all of that. But figure $15-$20. The setup has always been, my kids are in their 20s. They're going to a dinner party. They're going to look like shitheads with a $9, $10 bottle. They're not spending $35,
$40.
Not yet. So if they can get in at $18, $20, $15, $17 with an oh wow wine, what are they doing red and white?
So the first name that came to my head, and this is why it fits both, would be Guigal.
Okay, G-U-I-G-A-L
exactly.
From the Rhone?
Exactly.
Okay.
And I think most of us know Guigal from his, you know, super amazing Lalas wines that
Landon, right, Leturc.
But his, you know, Cote de Rhone blends,
his village wines,
the Blancs are incredible values.
So you feel as strongly, I know the reds are great values, the whites are
absolutely
terrific values.
And I think it's always a surprise when you bring a white wine from Rhone, and most people are, they first thing, right, they start scratching their heads and they're like, wow, this wine's actually amazingly delicious.
Matthew, that's how you answer that question.
Perfect.
Good job. All right. So good job on that. We're going to post your answers on our social media, our Facebook page, our Instagram page, as we do every week. So if people want to, you know the specifics of what we talked about, we document it. All right, Matt, every week we taste a different wine on air. It's part of our weekly wine sip. We're going to taste a 2015 Chateau Montelena estate wine, top of the list for your place. Tell me a little more about this wine.
So we started making this wine in the late 1970s as a, you know, originally an expression of place. So in America, as most of us remember, there was a big push towards reserve wines, but we really never jumped on that bandwagon. So this is really a combination of our best hillside vineyards, our best alluvial blocks, and what you get is, again, those layers of flavor, complexity, and most importantly, a real window into the vintage and the site. So this is really a wine that can't be made anywhere else.
So when you say we don't make a reserve wine, mm-hmm, I mean, is that just words, or no, is there something that has to be reserved?
So this is us tasting through these blocks, knowing what their potential is, farming them appropriately, you know, making, you know, fermenting and aging them appropriately to highlight the best parts of their individual characters. And then when you put that together in this beautiful assemblage, you get something that is wonderfully unique.
Nice. All right. So let's evaluate this wine. Let's give it a sniff and we'll throw it over the tongue.
Sure.
And we'll see what's going on here. So let's start with color.
Sure.
As like most good Napa Cabs and certainly Montelena, it's a pretty dark brooding wine.
Absolutely.
What's the color descriptor on this?
This isn't quite garnet. There's still some purple around the edges.
The edges, right?
There's
garnet would be just the black glass.
Right.
Okay.
And so there's
but it's beautiful, the edging.
It is, and I think that's, again, we're not drinking ink here. This is Cabernet.
All right, let's go nose. I want you to give me your descriptors. You should be good at this by now.
Yeah, the marketing speak, right?
Well, don't BS me. What are we smelling here?
So I think the first thing, we'll start off with what we're not smelling. So this is not an oak-driven wine.
No,
right?
No heavy oak.
That's
on
right.
The nose.
So this is really the site. So, and 15 was a very just, you know, fruit-forward, rich vintage, and so we worked really hard to be able to highlight that. So I'd say predominantly this is a nice, this is a kind of a cacophony of red and dark fruits. Definitely the raspberry and blackberry come through very prominently. There was also, on some of those really high up hillside blocks, we typically get a lot of perfume. And so,
it is perfumey.
Yeah, there's some really beautiful perfume on this.
It is perfumey. All right, let's go mouthfeel.
Okay, great.
It's a big wine.
It is.
It's not crazy, unctuous, glycerin-y.
Not yet. And I think
it will evolve to that.
It is. So remember, we're talking about a 30 plus year wine here.
Okay.
And so the challenge on our side is, how do you make this wine delicious upon release, but also when you lose it for 25 years in your cellar, Sam, and you find it, it still has to taste good.
So now it's a medium plus, or even a little beyond that.
But it'll flesh out over time, and you notice the acidity right off the bat. That's the kind of the backbone that gives us the ageability. Again, beautiful fruit. And if you let this wine open up in the glass for a little bit of time, and I'm not a huge fan of decanting for this reason, you'll start getting some of those secondary characters that we were talking about before.
So with this wine, don't decant, just let it evolve in the glass as you pour it out?
That's fine? Exactly. Beau says that, it's Beau Barrett, my boss, our CEO, he says that decanting is like skipping to the end of the movie. You want to enjoy everything that happens, and we really think about that when we're making the blend. So this wine will certainly evolve in the glass over the next few hours.
All right, so let's do palate. Do the palate descriptors match the nose, or are there other things there?
So you're there's definitely going to be that fruit component from the vintage, but you notice the tannins are still angular, but they're also fine at the same time. Those will soften and really broaden with some time in glass.
Let's tell people the tannins are what? The tart thing, or the dry, the puckering
thing. Right.
When you say it's angular.
Right.
I guess when you say it's smooth, it's almost...
Everyone gets that.
Seamless. Yeah. But when you say it's angular, what should people expect to feel in the mouth?
So the best way I've been able to explain this to people is, you have to go into your house and get a couple pieces of fabric and use it, because tannins are a tactile sensation.
Right.
So you should get a piece of cotton and feel that. That's relatively smooth. You should get a piece of sandpaper and feel something prickly, some burlap, some satin. All those sensations are basically...
So smooth, grainy, small grainy, exactly. Out there. That's, so angular is feeling that grain.
Exactly. And so, tannins are what we taste in tea, if you will. It's a sensation, not a flavor.
All right. Tell me what's a good pair for this wine. What would we pair this with?
Ooh, that's a tough one. Not because it's not pairable, but because you can go so many different directions now with this.
Easy.
Right.
Asparagus. Come on, it's not that tough.
No. So I think in New York you have plenty of really great options. I mean, this is right now, this is a great red sauce wine for sure. As this wine starts to age and develop.
When you say red sauce, so a bowl of pasta?
Absolutely.
Chicken parm with a lot of sauce?
Totally.
Veal parm?
And I think that's really the mark of a good wine, is that you have that ability to really pair it with anything.
What
that's
about
good.
What people usually expect you to say, which is
red
a big
meat.
Bloody steak?
Right.
It's fine with that?
Of course. And I think that it's less about the food necessarily calming the wine down. It's more about the wine helping make the food taste better,
which is really what wine and food is about.
Exactly.
Now, don't fight. They should complement each other. Do you like this wine? Are you happy with it?
So as a winemaker, I'm always looking for what I don't like about it in terms of what
All
we
right,
can
I'm
do
better. I'm curious about that.
Sure.
Because it's a very highly regarded wine.
Yeah, it's a super highly
regarded
wine.
So if you're picking, at something that came out pretty well. So what is that?
So I think for us, we always have this nod towards, constant improvement. And I think what this wine is, a bold, powerful wine. And I think over time, some of the more interesting nuances will come out. So these are the
different... Will the tannins smooth out?
They will.
Okay.
And I'd say if that's one thing that...
There's a teeny bit of alcohol, which I don't mind. Will that
it
calm
will.
Down
and
a
And
little?
This is, this is a 14.2, 14.3
right.
wine.
Not crazy,
no.
But there's alcohol there.
Exactly. And so I'd say, if anything, we don't want the Montalena character to get lost in any of our wines. And I think this is a great expression for a very ripe vintage. But I'm always looking for ways I can do things better.
Okay. That sounds good. So this is the 2015 Chateau Montalena Cabernet Sauvignon. This is what's on the market. It's the estate. It says Montalena Estate on the top of the label in a gold band. Matt said it's not a bad idea to eat this with a nice big chicken parm, which sounds good to me. All right, Matt, we got to wrap up the show. If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Follow us on Facebook @The Grape Nation. Follow us on Instagram at SBenRuby and the hashtag The Grape Nation. On Twitter, we're at BenRuby and the hashtag The Grape Nation. You can subscribe to Grape Nation podcasts on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. Like I said earlier, we'll post Matt's wine list answers and our weekly wine sip selection on all of our social media in the next few days. Matt, if we want to find you and Chateau Montelena on social media, where can we look to?
So the winery is at Montelena.com. Okay. Contact us on Facebook, Twitter, phone, email. If you want to see me, come to the winery.
Okay, and if people want to follow you, do you do much social media?
No, I
don't. Damn, you got to get out of the basement. I'm telling you. Too much ping pong. All right, I want to thank our guest, Matt Crafton. Matt is the head winemaker at legendary Chateau Montelena. Thanks to our engineers and everyone at Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam BenRuby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.